Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for once again joining us on another Journal Club. I would ask that if you're not speaking, to put yourself on mute. And we will go ahead and kick it off. We are very excited today to be talking about something I think is pretty much on the forefront of our mind, which is infection control and our policies. What I want to do is start by going through our agenda, and we're going to go over, as per usual, our COVID-19 state of the state. So we are seeing that in the United States, we have over 1.8 million confirmed cases. We have seen significant recovery, but we did eclipse over 100,000 deaths last week, and we're still seeing, while we're not seeing a steady progression, we're still seeing more cases and more deaths associated with this condition. When we look at the COVID-19 projections, you know, I think we've gone over this data a couple of times, and we've seen, as is predicted, that this graphic moves quite a bit. You know, given the reopening of states, we're anticipating that we're going to see some more movement, as well as with the recent protests that we're seeing, we expect that we may see another spike come the beginning of July. So, you know, it's always moving. You know, there has been some flattening of the curve. And today we really want to go into, you know, some updates around how we continue to prepare and what our infection control policies need to look like. So as we go into the literature update, I want to start with a study, you know, and I apologize. We saw that in Florida, we're still running pretty high with 57,000 plus cases. We do see that the trajectory of our deaths by date has gone down. But if you look at the graphic up on your right-hand side, you'll see that the cases per day has increased. And I think that may be a little bit in relation to the fact that we had some areas reopening. If you go on, we're going to jump into our literature update because I want to make sure we have enough time for our discussion with Dr. Malott. So the first study that I wanted to review is really something that we highlighted on our deep dive a few weeks ago. And this study from Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology is brought to us by Dr. Garr and many people that we know from AMDA, and is the Unprecedented Solutions for Extraordinary Times, Helping Long-Term Care Settings Deal with COVID-19 Pandemic. And if you advance to the next slide, Shane, for me, you know, the recommendations from this study that we saw, were that SNF should only accept patients with active COVID-19 infections if they could provide isolation, airborne isolation. Another big one was that if you're having patients who are recovering from COVID-19 infections, they need to have two negative COVID-19 tests on two consecutive days. And I can definitely attest to the fact that in South Florida, especially in Broward County, that recommendation is being actually honored by most of our facilities. You will not see a facility in my knowledge, that isn't holding the hospitals to that criteria. They also recommended that SNFs should screen all potential admissions for both typical and atypical symptoms. What that has translated to down here is that we're really screening everyone who is going to be admitted. So most of the facilities that I'm aware of are not admitting patients if they do not have a test for COVID-19. I wanted to just highlight, though, the atypical symptoms. If you go to the next slide, we have this in our COVID-19 library, as do we have this whole entire article. But this is really something that Dr. Garr shared with us a few weeks ago about the typical symptoms, signs and symptoms, which we are all very aware of, as well as the atypical signs and symptoms, the confusion, exacerbations of certain conditions, muscle aches, the GI symptoms. So I think we're all pretty much aware of that. If we go through some of the other recommendations that they are highlighting, on the next slide, they are also recommending that if there are any COVID-19 naive facilities left in this country, they should not be accepting any new admissions that they suspect may have COVID-19. There's also an emphasis for hospitals and SNFs, both the acute and long-term care settings, to really work together so that we can transition patients appropriately, especially when you're looking at people who cannot return to their community settings. And then SNFs need to, I think we could all attest and agree that SNFs need to be designated as high priority sites. In Florida, they are, but there's still quite a bit of variability from state to state. So I wanted to, if we proceed to the next article, this is an article that said pre-proof, and it is a policy recommendations from clinicians, CMDs who are in New York State. If you look, Dr. Lester Paula Lester presented a bit at AMDA, and Dr. Healy, not only did she present at AMDA, she spoke on our call a few months ago, I believe April 1st. So, providers that we know, and what they are looking at when we were looking through this study is quite comprehensive. This is their recommendations based off of practicing in the state of New York, practicing in facilities. And we do know that New York was, I believe, the first state that had a mandate where patients who were COVID-19 positive, who were discharged from the hospital, had to go into the SNFs, that the SNF could not refuse that patient, which was something that we, here in Florida, really approached our government to, note our disagreement, and other states did so. But there were some other states who did have such arrangements as well. So the amount of information that they have coming out of their facilities has been quite robust. And, where the highlights are for this article, as you see, it is quite comprehensive. They really focused in on dedicated staff to care for COVID-19 positive patients. They spoke a lot about the test-based and non-test-based strategies, for looking at how to care and isolate these patients. And the non-test-based strategy was that you would have at least 3 days that has passed its recovery before saying that someone was able to come out of isolation. There are also a test-based strategy where you looked at lack of fever, improvement in respiratory symptoms, and negative results for at least 2 consecutive days, 24 hours apart. They also went into descriptions of how to cohort COVID-19 patients and building dedicated COVID-19 units, which we've heard a great deal about, having a separate either wing or area where we could cohort those residents. And what I thought was interesting, we do know that as patients are coming out, if they had those 2 tests, they may not have actually show positive, even if they recently became infected with the virus. So they recommended a transition unit for new admits that are COVID-19 negative. There were further recommendations on required PPE, with a lot of emphasis on utilizing face shields and N95s, which we know has been a great issue. And when you get a chance, I would definitely say we really need to really pay attention to how they're describing providing palliative care and advanced care planning. and the issues around deprescribing. So I just wanted to bring this to your attention. It is in recently published in JAMDA. As I said, it's a journal that pre-proofed, so there is some further editing that is going to happen with this article, but it is available at the on the JAMDA's website, and now as well at our COVID-19 library. If we go to the next slide, so this is a position statement from the National Center for Infectious Diseases and the Chapter of Infectious Disease Physicians, Academy of Medicine in Singapore. This came out last week as well. And it has been circulating amongst many people because it does provide a different look into some of the data. They were able to review over 14 studies and really draft a position on de-isolation that is that has worked in their favor, I would say. So if we go to the next slide, you know, the key points on effectivity that they looked at were viral RNA detection by PCR does not equal viable virus or infectiousness, as they coined it. Another finding was that when the viral load is low, there is no viable virus found. And what they are looking at is some of their local data where they analyzed 766 patients, and they found that on day 15 from onset of illness, 30% of all the COVID-19 patients were PCR negative by nasal pharyngeal swab. And it rose to 68% by day 21, 88% by day 28, and by day 33 was at 95%. So as I said, they looked through several studies, and another study where they looked at a cohort of 73 COVID-19 patients, they found that the cycle threshold value for which is the marker that they use for viral load was 30 or higher, which indicated that the viral load was low and that there was no viable virus. When they are describing viable virus, they mean that virus that can be detected or cultured, so isolated or cultured. So it's a little bit different. So in this position, they're really stating that even though there may be persistence of RNA, PCR detection of RNA, the viable virus was not found after the second week of illness. And that's something that I think we will definitely talk to Dr. Malad about. If you go to the next slide, Shane, you know, I want to get into this discussion because we really need to start thinking about how do we move forward with all of the information that we have and that we don't have. And one of those things that was noted in the Singapore paper is that there is a lack of data around asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic individuals. So we're still at the beginning of getting understanding what we need to do for this condition. So I thought it would be a good time for us to really just take a moment and see, okay, where do we need to go and how do we need to evolve? And with that, we're going to have Dr. Malad, your bio is so extensive, but he has worked with nursing facilities for many years as both an attending, I believe a consultant, as well as a medical director. He is an infectious disease specialist and a fellow of the Infectious Disease Society of America, as well as other organizations. And, you know, I will not butcher your bio, so I will let you introduce yourself to Dr. Malad.
Hello, good afternoon. In looking at all of these articles that you reviewed, one of the things you have to be very careful about, we're just being pummeled with so much information every day. And it's difficult sometimes to tease out exactly what's going on. For instance, that in the timeliness of these papers, for instance, the paper by Gar et al. Was actually originally published online at the end of March. So that means that these people were writing in sometime in March. And I think a lot of things have changed during that time. I think And Diane mentioned that in South Florida, you're using, in terms of admissions into the facility, screening tests, the RT-PCR tests, two negative ones. And I think that clearly is evolving based on the Singapore data that she reviewed. It's clear that these persistently positive tests don't indicate evidence of viable organisms. They're just a residual RNA that's in the secretions, and that's pretty much been worked out at this point. So I think the going to the non-test strategy is the way to go. And it's becoming less of an issue, I think, because of the hospital bed situation, ICU bed situation is much better off than it was originally. And I think Diane gave me a list of questions about, and you know, obviously the gold standard test right now is the PCR. I think actually the information from the PCR you usually don't get, which is the cycle threshold. And if anybody read these articles, especially the one from Singapore, you'll understand that the cycle threshold is actually the important aspect of the test if it's positive. And there's an inverse correlation between the cycle threshold and the viral load. So when a test comes back positive, it really doesn't tell you much about the viral load. So in the Singapore paper, they talk about the cycle threshold of greater than 30 as being evidence of a very low viral load, or possibly just remnants of the organism and not really a viable organism being present. So that's a piece of information which you don't get usually in the test, unfortunately, but it is very useful. The viral load is usually highest 2 to 3 days before symptoms and then for about 7 days following symptoms, and then it just drops off. But there's these persistently positive tests, which originally were difficult to understand until people started culturing these specimens and found no viable virus. The other thing that Diane mentioned at the end there was this issue about asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic people, which is kind of interesting. I just reviewed a paper for a journal that describes a nursing home with 97 residents in Massachusetts, in which they said at the beginning of the study, they had no cases of coronavirus in their residents. They then went about testing every single resident using PCR and found 85% of them positive. And which really was unexpected. And it's amazing that they got that much positivity in a so-called asymptomatic population. And they probably weren't asymptomatic. They just were atypically symptomatic, as Diane points out. So you have to be very careful about these so-called naive homes, which probably don't exist, as Diane said already, anymore. But I think the testing strategy should be using the PCR to identify people with active infection. The antibody studies are probably not going to be of any value in detecting cases. And they're just population-based information at this point in time. I mean, I'm going to stop. The other thing I want to mention before I stop, and if there's any questions, is if you look at the New York State paper, which is interesting, one of the things that they don't mention in that paper is the issue of family members visiting residents in nursing homes. And I don't know what's happening. I'm actually right now in New York State. And for the several months that this was going on, family members have not been allowed into nursing homes. So people have been dying without their family members present. This has been a major issue for families. And there is a paper which is in that pre-proof situation, like the New York State paper, about family members actually being essential caregivers. And I guess I could ask Diane, what's the situation with that in Florida?
Yeah, well, I would say that we are, in many of our facilities, we're trying to figure out a way to have family members come back in, whether it is having them do visits via like a televisit with the family members. Some of the facilities have incorporated that. We were fortunate enough to have Dr. Gronin on last week, and he mentioned having outdoor family visitations with social distancing in mind. But I think we're still trying to explore what we need to do. There are some facilities across the country who are doing the window visitations, but there's not any, I would say, uniformity to or standard to what everyone is doing. Each facility is sort of doing their own thing, and I worry about the variability because we do know that it is essential for patients, especially are more frail, and I feel that the patients with dementia to have those relationships that they are familiar with is essential for them to interact. You know, before we go any deeper in that, I wanted to know if we could address, you know, the false negative rates that we're seeing. You know, I think in the beginning we were seeing very high false negative rates. I'm pretty sure that some areas are still seeing that. How should we be addressing, Dr. Malott, how should we be addressing the high false negative rates that we've been seeing?
You're talking about with the PCR?
With the PCR, yes.
Well, one of the problems was the original testing was faulty from CDC. I personally don't think there's any major problem now with false negatives, at least as far as I know. I haven't seen that as a major issue in any of the literature that I'm aware of. It's possible that people are, well, that's all I can say about that. It's surprising that you brought that up, actually, because I wasn't aware of that as being a major issue at this point in time. Maybe you could go into more detail about that. I don't.
Yeah, it is still a question that I've been getting a lot from our members and participants of the Journal Club. We are also, you know, I know that there was a concern over a false positive, but pretty much we were still concerned over the fact that we think that we may be seeing people who have presumed COVID-19, yet their study, the test shows up as a negative result. So I guess, I'm hoping that is getting better, but I haven't seen any significant literature to speak.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
To that.
Yeah, when you say false negative, that means at some point in time they were diagnosed with the infection. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and Dr. Edwards actually just posted a question. He had a patient who tested positive in the nursing home, went to the hospital, and was sent back because he tested negative. So I guess that's a false positive. Any Any idea of why we may be seeing that?
You know, false positives are related to the, you know, the specificity of the test. It's a highly specific test, the PCR. It also depends on the lab doing it. The hospital has probably potentially doing it in their own laboratory versus where the nursing home is sending the specimen. So you have to be careful with that. I haven't heard of that sequence. That's kind of an odd sequence. Not surprised that it might happen at some point in time. The other thing is that there's a lot of viral infection floating around as well. That would tend more for false positivity than false negativity. So I haven't seen any literature on false negativity like you're describing there. And so I'm puzzled by that, actually. And Dr. Edwards says that it's happened twice to him. So my comment to him is, find out where he's sending his tests versus where the hospital is.
Dr. Malott, I had a question about what should be the criteria for establishing a dedicated COVID-19 unit, if you had any thoughts around what really should define these units?
I think the first thing is, does the facility have the staff to do that? And do they have the PPE and supply of PPE to manage that? And then do they have the ability to set up a separate unit to handle that? And those are multiple issues. And then if the answer is yes to all those, then then fit testing has to go on, because N95 masks are going to be needed for staff. And there's a whole bunch of other issues which were outlined in the New York State document, as you recall, all the other issues there about dedicating the people who do the cleaning of the rooms and therapists and all sorts of other issues. And so it's a fairly complicated situation. See, and I know of one nursing home in my area where I am around Buffalo, New York, that specifically did that for one part of their nursing home when this mandate in New York State came down to that required all nursing homes to take patients who were positive. I don't know if they ever admitted anybody to that facility, to be honest with you, to that unit. But they would have had to gone through all of those steps. So I think it's fairly rigorous. The other thing that you mentioned on one of your slides early on there was about airborne isolation. And of course, no nursing home can do that because it requires negative pressure ventilation. And so the recommendation because of that is to put people into a single room with the door closed. And that causes all sorts of issues in terms of falls happening and not knowing what's happened in the room and all sorts of other things like that. So it's difficult for nursing homes to deal with this. If I could bring up one other issue.
Yes, please.
Really disconcerting to me, and that is efforts going on in New York State and New Jersey of investigations because of the high rate of disinfection in nursing home residents and death. And there's two active investigations, one in New Jersey, actually of the governor, and then in New York State, there's investigation specifically of nursing homes being started by the New York State Attorney General. And I think this is something that we all have to be mindful of and careful of. And a point was made in the GAR paper that alludes to this, the fact that they stated that the high rates are not due to lapses so much in infection control, once the organism, once there's an index case in the facility, especially if there's no much in the way of symptoms, the organism can spread, as was seen in that paper that I reviewed from the Massachusetts facility. So this is a major problem. And now CMS has just come out 2 days ago with their punitive approach to dealing with these nursing homes, which I think everybody should be concerned about. I don't know if you've seen that memo from CMS two days ago, June 1st, about fines and so forth related to infection control deficiencies. But this is a major issue that is going to face all nursing homes.
Yes, and it leads me into the next question about what do you envision, do you envision a time when cohorting residents would be regulated and a required component of our preparedness and infection control policies, you know, and thinking about what CMS came out, you know, I would love to have your opinion on what you think may happen with that.
I hope it doesn't happen as a mandate, because I think it creates a tremendous liability for nursing homes. And which has already started, actually. You know, there's some liability, some lawsuits already going on regarding this kind of thing, deaths and so forth in nursing homes. So, and even though there was some kind of statement about waiving this liability for nursing homes, at least in New York State. I would be very concerned about that, because the liability is unbelievably high. It's high already. Don't forget the pandemic situation, but it'd be much higher in with those kind of mandates, I think. That's my own bias. And others may have their own opinion about that.
Let us just move forward a bit, and then we'll get some other questions in here. What are the steps do you think we need to be taking right now for PPE shortages and variability in available PPEs throughout the SNFs? And let me just frame the question a little bit more. I know what was mentioned in the New York State paper. I also have become aware of many things that, you know, the lacking of resources for many of our rural facilities and some of our more urban facilities. You know, we've heard of facilities using gowns to protect themselves, patient resident gowns to protect themselves because they can't get the paper gowns and those sorts of things. What do we need to do in thinking, you know, as medical directors and attendings and clinicians in this space to get our SNFs to start looking at these PPE shortages to prepare for either a next wave or the future of what may be coming?
Well, you know, I think it's a situation where the federal government needs to step up here and make sure that there's enough PPE available. They have delegated that primarily to states to some extent. I think, given what we know about the problem of this infection in nursing homes, nursing homes by themselves cannot deal with this. And we need a lot of assistance federally to get the PPE that's needed. And that's all I'm going to say about it. I mean, it's impossible otherwise to do it, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with that. It, you know, I had one clinician who said they saw for the state of Florida, you know, many of you may be aware that the National Guard has come into many of our facilities and were doing testing. Their PPE compared to what the clinicians had and the building had was a huge variability. So I've addressed a lot of questions around what do we need to do to get better. And going forward, you know, I want to just think about de-isolation, you know, which is really where the Singapore paper, you know, talked about their policies. And in the New York paper, they had it listed online 206 as discontinued transmission-based precautions. I'm really curious, Dr. Malat, to know what should our de-isolation policies look like? You know, how should we, plan and prepare for de-isolation?
Well, I think, the New York paper sort of specifies it, I think, fairly well. I mean, they're using two strategies, or suggesting, right, in what you're talking about. Not the non-testing strategy, I think, is pretty reasonable at this point, knowing what we know about how long there is viable virus in secretions. I think if you want to go to a test strategy, you're talking about testing or non-testing strategies, right?
Yes.
I think non-testing strategy is the way to go. It's a simpler one to deal with. Because you're going to see persistently positive people by PCR. I think that's the way to go. Those criteria are pretty reasonable as far as I'm concerned. And facilities are doing that. Some facilities, and if you look at some of the forums that are floating around, AMDA, AGS, and the infection control forums, they all suggest that that's a reasonable way to go at this point. So that's what I would primarily suggest, especially if testing availability is less than optimal. Someone wrote in about this false negative story. After looking at the test after someone's been exposed, and that would make sense that if you're looking at exposures to someone who's been infected and you test them right away, they may be negative. And then if you test them 5 days later, they're positive. But that's a function of the time it takes for the organism to take hold, multiply, and be identified in specimens. So that's sort of an understandable thing. So if you're testing too soon after an exposure, and sometimes you don't know exactly when the exposure occurred, you might get a negative test. That's the so-called pre-symptomatic stage, if you will.
And just to clarify, in the New York paper, starting on line 206, if you are following along or you have the paper, you can starting on line 206, they have a statement about discontinued transmission-based precautions. And the reference that Dr. Malat was referring to is the non-test-based strategy with at least 3 days, 72 hours past its recovery, and recovery defined as a resolution of fever without the use of fever-reducing medications. Then improvement in respiratory symptoms is also defined as that, so improvement in any cough, shortness of breath that the resident may be having, and at least 14 days past symptoms attributed to COVID-19 first appeared. So that is the non-test-based strategy. The test-based strategy refers to having two negative results from at least two consecutive COVID-19 molecular assays at least 24 hours apart. And what they mention in the New York paper is that they have been, many of the physicians have been using a combination of those two. So I do think, if you, if in your busy section, if you don't have time to look at anything else, I would encourage you to look at that part of the paper. It starts at line 206. And moving forward, if we could go to the next slide, Dr. Malott, I just, you know, before we open it up to everyone, I wanted to know what you thought of in looking at where we're at and where we need to go from here. What are the essential concerns and issues that SNFs and providers and our post-acute long-term care space need to have addressed? You know?
Well, we already talked about having enough supply of PPE. That's obviously a key issue, regardless of whether or not you have a cohorted unit or however you're going to be facing people with this infection in the nursing home, one way or the other. So having the correct amount of PPE available or a supply that you can count on is key. And remember, you have to fit test people for N95s, and people have to be educated about infection control procedures over and over again, because you're going to have staff turnover. I mean, that's always been a big problem. So I think that's a major factor in trying to deal with this. And then what's been a problem, I know, in some of the New York State homes is the lack of communication between the home and families about what's going on in facilities. So communication is a major issue. And that was a comment that was made in the New York State paper. Keeping lines of communication open, that's been a major stumbling block here in New York State up until recently. And then the communication with hospitals in the area is also important, as was also brought up. And others, I think those, the fit testing story, I think, is really a major. In the future, nursing homes need to be as prepared as possible, because this is going to be an ongoing problem for the next year or so, for sure. So rather than going through this whole story again, like we are now, I think nursing homes need to take a look at the recommendations from CDC about how to prepare in the long run for dealing with this.
Yeah, and I would pose a question maybe to our larger audience out there. Have prior to this pandemic, do we know of any facilities that were doing fit tests for their staff who may have had to use an N95 mask? Is anyone aware of that being part of what any of the facilities out there were doing? Yeah, I see someone said no. I'm not aware of that either. I know that it was something that I feel like I haven't done that. Since residency. I am curious to know, what we are doing on a day-to-day that we would need to really adjust. I think that is one of those things that if you're the medical director at your facility or one of the clinicians at the facility, we may need to really see, do we do this on a, when we're looking at the getting a new person onboarded, or getting onboarded to a facility, should that just be part of what we are now doing, so that we know?
Diane, this is Greg. From your time with Optum and now with United, I think, I'm not talking about facilities, but at least our staff, if it wasn't every year, it was at least every 2 years, did go through the N95 fit testing for the practitioners, NPs and PAs from our company that were going into buildings that were required to be fit tested and have one. But I can't think of a time, even going back before the time I worked for Optum 10 years ago starting, that it was actually ever needed like this. So it just shows you that some of the things that I thought about this. I'm glad you brought it up. Some of the things that we think are never going to happen, we're never going to have a pandemic, we're never going to have this or that. It's why we have to prepare for them. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
Yeah, it is something that I, you know, I think when I was rounding at one of the many hospitals that I used to attend at, we were always prepared to have the, South Florida have a TB patient, a suspected TB patient present. And we had the negative pressure control rooms in the hospital, and you would always have N95s around, and you need to, do fit testing and those type of things. But in the nursing facility, even when we say, as Dr. Malott, you mentioned earlier, there is no negative pressure rooms in most of our facilities. So airborne precautions is different, and it looks different. I know that many of the facilities that I've worked in, we had those masks available, but the standard of care was not the same as in the hospital. So I do think that's a big takeaway that we need to incorporate in our infection control policies. Going back to the regulations, and the liabilities, I don't know if any of anyone on the call, are you seeing any concerns from your nursing home administrators or DONs about issues as it relates to liabilities? I do know of several cases, and I was aware of what's happening in New York and New Jersey, but and being in Florida, we do see lawsuit advertisements all the time. I think on one of the channels, they come on quite a bit. So I'm just curious to see what you guys may be experiencing out there in the community.
I can just say that I've heard about it verbally. I haven't seen anything in writing yet, but I did see a TV news report that there is a law firm based in Orlando. I probably don't need to say the name, so I won't. But they have offices in every city in the country who are actively engaging and proactively going after families to get them to enter into a class action suit. Unfortunately, it's against a home that we've worked with and is a really good home, but had an unfortunate set of cases with the Opus chain. They are a great organization, do a great job, but I think we're going to see this more and more, unfortunately, now that the biggest one in the state has in the country has jumped into the fray.
Yeah.
Oh, Diane, I can speak to that a little bit, okay, seeing that I am the medical director of Coquina, which is the center that Greg's referencing. And if some of you in the Central Florida area may have seen, there was an article in the Sentinel a couple of weeks ago regarding the action of this particular law group taking action against two facilities in the state. I can't remember, think of the other name, and Coquina was one of them. Nothing more I can tell you. FHCA had a nice symposium, a one-hour webinar about a week ago, whatever, where they had their legal representative kind of, go through some of the do's and don'ts and the importance of having, certainly all your I's dotted, T's crossed. I forget the exact terminology. It was a COVID response box or something like that, okay, where you had even copies. As we know, the CDC will even take down. Dr. Malott can perhaps, or others can perhaps, speak to this better than I can. But from time to time, they'll actually take down some of their guidance when it becomes outdated. So it's important to have documented in hard copy the guidance from early March from the CDC, which was, we know, can change, has changed to a certain extent with regard to various aspects over the past 2 to 3 months. The other point, okay, is that I can tell you that Coquina has had in the last 8 weeks no less than four separate comprehensive surveys by ACA in addition to the Department of Health. And the positive, if there can be a positive with regard to potential medical legal down the pike, is that there were no deficiencies found from A to Z from the beginning to current with regard to infection control practices, et cetera. So if there's one piece of armamentarium I'd like to have in your pocket, it's probably that, not if, but when you're faced with legal action.
Thank you, Dr. Kaplan. That was wonderful. Thank you. So before we conclude, I just want to make sure, does anyone have any other questions, concerns, or issues that we would like to raise at this point of time?
Yes, Dr. Edwards, can you hear me this time?
Yes, we can, Dr. Edwards.
Yeah, back to my original scenario where we had two different patients from the same nursing home that were tested by the health department's lab. They were positive, so this particular home was required by the health department because they were under the watch list to send all their positive patients to the hospital. When they went to the hospital, they did a rapid test and said that they were negative and sent the patients back, and that's how they got. So there was a difference between the health department, Florida Health Department lab, wherever that was, and the rapid test that was done in the hospital facility.
So in that situation, I would think that the Department of Health laboratory takes precedent over the rapid test, for sure. The issue is, did the hospital know that the Department of Health did the test? Do you know that?
Yes, they did.
So the onus is on them, not you or whoever's involved, to deal with that, because the Department of Health is probably doing a better test, let's put it that way. That's the problem with the multiple testing situation. I haven't heard that particular problem happening twice like that. But I think it's a function of how the hospital is dealing with this large influx of people who may have the infection. So that's pretty interesting.
Do you think it could be, Dr. Malott, the maybe human error involved in testing? The discrepancy between Department of Health and the hospital's rapid study, or?
Yes. I mean, that's another possibility. Yeah, absolutely. But again, I think it the onus is on the hospital to deal with that, not to send the person back. Given the situation with the hospital overload at some point, they're willing to just toss those people back, based on regardless of what other testing has been available, symptoms, and so forth. That's, to me, in my view, what I would ask Dr. Edward, did you contact the Department of Health and pursue that a little bit with them?
I didn't personally contact, but I know the Department of Health was involved in this facility on a daily basis and was not only monitoring the activity, but directing the activity of what happened with each patient that tested either negative or positive, because again, this facility was under a watch list and had a big outbreak. The Department of Health accepted them back. I mean, they had to go through the Department of Health. The nursing home had to go through the Department of Health before they accepted them back, and the Department of Health said, yes, bring them back. So
I guess that wasn't
very, what else to say?
No, I would, depends on who you're dealing with in that situation with the Department of Health. But one might want to, go deeper into that and see if you can, if that's been a problem beyond what you've experienced. Because if it is, then that's another reason why the organism spread in a facility. potentially. But I hadn't heard of that, about that sequence before, but enough.
And it might have been, now that I'm thinking back, it might have been at the time this hospital system had a lab they were using that was not handling things correctly. And since then, they've put out a notice that they've changed labs. So I don't remember exactly the time frame, if it was before that change in labs or not. So it might have been a problem with the hospital lab. And but so far, those patients we've been monitoring are still asymptomatic and haven't had any problems.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Well, everyone, I thank you for all of your questions. Dr. Malad, I thank you for joining this call and giving us the pleasure of hearing everything that you discussed and sharing your expertise with us. If you guys have any questions or comments, please direct them to me. And I thank everyone for making themselves available again. Talk to you next week.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.